The legends and stories of Florida are innumerable. 100 writers could but scratch the surface in a lifetime of endeavor telling about this land of flowers, its history, its people, and things like the dark reaches of the swamps where the owl's cries mournful, the lone bull gator on an acorn ridge surrounded by wild hogs, their tushies gleaming white and sticky red and fire in their eyes, beautiful sand and water where the Calusa lived, the billowed sails of the Spaniard ships, colonization, building of the old fort at St. Augustine, the Seminole long-drawn-out wars, and statehood. But listen, for the wind sings its secrets to the listening ear no written word can describe.
Wherever I wander, in summer or winter, the ocean is calling me back to Florida's sand, 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 to Florida's sand, sand, sand. The wind and the ocean are calling me back to the sand, 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 to Florida's sand, sand, sand. Waves softly sparkle beneath the bright moon. Night birds are crying, return to me soon. Oh, Florida, Florida, my heart you ever, for always the love of this man is Florida's sand, 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 is Florida's sand, sand, sand. Beautiful sun-kissed land, oh Florida sand.
Outside of a few exceptions, the rivers and lakes of Florida have kept the names given them by the Indians. They sound musical when properly pronounced. Escambia, Choctahatchee, Chattahoochee, Wakulla, Ocklawkney, Owislacoochee, Wekiva, Okeechobee, and the Suwannee, immortalized by Stephen Foster. The most beautiful river of them all is the Ocklawaha, now doomed by the Cross State Barge Canal. These are a few of the more well-known streams, but historically, the most significant river in the state is the Apalachicola, one time called the breadbasket of the South. Long before the Spanish had discovered Florida, Indian villages were scattered along this waterway. The rich soil produced vegetables for the communities. The forest and river gave meat and fish. The people lived in harmony and peace. In later years, before Georgia was formed and named, slaves from the Carolinas would manage to escape, eventually making their ways to one of the villages along the Apalachicola, where they would be accepted into the tribe. Through intermarriage and prolific breeding, their numbers increased rapidly over the following several generations, and these mixed bloods would be referred to as exiles. In the year 1814, two British ships anchored in Apalachicola Bay and began discharging men and equipment. Lieutenant Colonel Nichols was officer in charge of this expedition. Their purpose: find a site upriver and build a fort to control this strategic waterway. 30 miles from the mouth of the river, they built a strong fort, fully stocking it with cannon and smaller arms. They had no qualms that this was Spanish territory. The British suddenly evacuated this fort, going downriver to waiting ships and embarkation, leaving behind, to the bewilderment of the exiles, a complete arsenal of powder and weaponry. Andy Jackson, after his victory at New Orleans, was appointed commanding general with jurisdiction as far south as the territorial border. And from his headquarters at Nashville, Tennessee, orders were issued to Sailing Master Loomis at Mobile, Alabama, and an army officer, Colonel Clinch, stationed at a post on the Flint River. The orders stated that this Negro fort posed a threat and must be destroyed in all haste, and immediately thereafter return the captured slaves to their rightful owners. Colonel Clinch, with troops and Indian allies, embarked downriver. By midday July 25th, 1816, his troops were deployed, the cannon in place near the stronghold. Sailing Master Loomis left Mobile Bay with two gunboats and sailed upriver to anchor just below the fort. He was at battle stations by the 25th. Word of their coming had preceded the army, so by the time of its arrival, 334 exiles had fled to the fort for safety. After a short conference, Loomis and Clinch began shelling the fort, and for 2 days they kept it up, the balls having little or no effect against the thick walls. Another conference was held and a decision reached. The gunboats would this time use hot shot or heated cannonballs. The shelling was resumed. Over the walls, they lobbed the sizzling hot shot. One ball reached the powder magazine, and a resultant explosion killed 270 of the exiles outright and badly wounded most of the others. This episode brought about the First Seminole War.
Apalachicola River stood a fort, built by British engineers with cannon in each port. Protection from the slave forays that caused the exiles dread. Then they left it to the men whose color was of red. Black men came from South Carolina and Georgia filled with hope to seek this peaceful haven, no more to wear the yoke. Here the exiles lived and died, and from the heart gave thanks for this golden fruitful land along the river's banks. But the mighty force of greed reached out on every hand. This Negro fort must be destroyed, the slaves you will disband. Return them to their rightful owners, so the orders said. I'm 60 miles from Georgia's line, Blunt's fort was blown to shreds. Where the Flint and Chattahoochee join and flow to sea, Colonel Clinch from here did go, and many men had he. And from the Gulf the gunboats came with Loomis in command. There's no escape from Doom Blunt's fort by water or by land. Now the fort's surrounded and the shelling has begun. cannonballs a thuddin', smoke near hides the sun. On and on for 2 full days, and then before nightfall, Loomis said to Colonel Peach, "We'll give him red hot ball." White hot balls are whizzing, see the fiery way they glow. O'er the walls a bouncing, skittering to and fro. Straight into the powder magazine, this ball it went. Night was struck asunder with a hellish rend. Blood and gore and bodies torn are flying everywhere, and the stench of burning flesh fills the evening air. Oh, you lost 300, woman, child, and man. You didn't ever fire one shot, nor lift an angry hand. Now the river quietly runs by where the spirits sleep, past the side of old Blunt's Fort where the willers weep. From this dark deed sprung the fires that set this land aflame. It burned in the soul of the Seminole, the bitter war it came.
My grandfather, as a young man, left his home place in Alabama and took up land on Holmes Creek in North Florida. There he built his house and sired his young'uns. Sweet taters, corns, beans, squash, and greens were the usual fare served at the table. Ribbon, green, and red cane gave syrup and sugar. Wild mayhaw, blueberry, plum, and blackberry gave jam and jelly. Following bees to their bee tree, cutting a tree down and filling wooden tubs and buckets with wild honey was a joyful event. Smoke from smoldering old rags wrapped around sticks made the bees logy, but if someone did get stung, there was always a snuff dipper in the crowd to rub snuff on the stung place. Cured meats hung from rafters in a smokehouse on loops of bear grass. Barrels of pickled meat stood against the walls and corners, and sausages hung serpentine-like from hickory poles. Holmes Creek teemed with small pike, stump knocker, warmouth, and other edible fish and were easily caught. Flour was a luxury, and the infrequent smells of bacon were mouth-watering. Grandpa cut and rafted logs downriver to a sawmill where he'd trade them for hard money. Then he'd walk back along the river's bank, and at times he'd be away from his family for a week, camping and cooking near where he cut logs. But come noontime Saturday, all work would stop and he'd pack up, headed for home. This Saturday at noon, Grandpa gathered up his belongings, put them in a tote sack and haul buggy. Along about mid-afternoon, he came to a footbridge several hundred feet long, built above high water line and over the boggy swamp across a river to dry land on the other side. As he neared the part of the bridge that spanned the river, he heard a noise behind him. Turning around quickly, he beheld a huge panther loping down the bridge toward him. He swung the sack from his shoulder and threw it down on the bridge as close to the panther as he could and started running. The panther proceeded to rip the sack and its contents to pieces. When he'd finished, he took out after Grandpa. Grandpa was picking him up and laying him down. Upon glancing behind him, he saw the panther gaining. Off comes Grandpa's coat, and on the ground it goes. The panther stops and rips the coat to shreds. Next comes the shirt, the same treatment. By this time, Grandpa's in hollering distance of his house, and he's hollering for Grandma. He jumps a picket fence, grabs a shotgun from Grandma's hands, wheels, and as a panther leaps a fence, puts a load of buckshot in the panther's face and chest. That night, the Lord blessed Grandma with a life that would be my mother, and for several years after this foot race, Grandpa toted his gun. Years passed, Grandpa sold his homestead, resettling on a choice piece of land south of Chipley, Florida, not too far from Falling Water. There he built his home, dug his well, and sowed his seed. Off the coast of Florida, we Southerns know it well. That dirty vermin-ridden fort, it was a living hell. Tortugas was a prison camp,
and torture was her fame. Good men died, good men killed, good men maimed. Union forces did command, escape was not to be. The moats were filled with tiger shark, surrounded by the sea. Still men tried, and oh, they died, and in their deaths were free. Those who fought for a southern victory. Sad legend, your heart it will ring. I'll sing you the ballad of Silver Springs. I'll tell of Miss Mayo and where she does sleep in the bridal chamber, way down in the deep. Her true love had gone from this enchanted land to study and to practice the just laws of man. No word from her, darling, for over a year. Her heart, it was broken. She wasted in tears. She went to Aunt Cilla in late afternoon. Her death bell was knelling, the call would be soon. Aunt Cilla, I pledge you, for this do I crave. Please lower me down to my watery grave. And there in the wild, with this flower so fair, her spirit departed into the clear air. Aunt Cilla prepared her and wound her with sack, and lowered her gently into the great crack. Claire Douglas returned, and straightway he did go to Aunt Cilla's cabin to seek Miss Mayo. No trace did he find of his true love or friend, and the sound of strange music was the voice of the wind. This legend lives ever, my story does end. They're down there together, united again, and in love's sweet embrace forever do dwell. Neath the silvery waters that they love so well. O'er the mournful cry of the owl as he wings, o'er the pale moonlit beauty of Silver Springs, their love was so pure as the waters that flow down Silver River to the Ocklawaha. First known written reference was from the book of Exodus, chapter 7, verses 20 and 21. And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood, and the fish that was in the river died, and the river stank, and the people could not drink of the water of the river. Now, if you have been in a place stricken by the red tide, then you know that this song speaks true. The waters turn red, millions of pounds of dead fish wash ashore, entire towns become uninhabitable in the wake of this unexplained catastrophe. Jim Brevis. There's a name the Gulf folk dread, and he turns the waters red, leaves the fishes lying dead. Old Jim Brevis, he is red, red tide. When Jim Brevis comes to town, people know for miles around, buzzards dancing up and down, people puking on the ground, red tide. Heavy hangs the rotten stench, makes the stomach heave and wrench. Eyeballs burn and noses flinch. Lord of mercy, what a stench, red tide. Where he comes from, no one knows. He just comes and then he goes. Left behind the death he sows, reminded by each wind that blows. Red tide, red tide, red tide.
Weeks before Christmas, the members of this country church would write their names on a slip of paper and put them in a slotted container. The box would be thoroughly shaken to mix up the names. After this ritual, each member would file by, ram his or her hand in the box, and draw out a slip. You were honor-bound to give a gift to the person whose name you drew. However, it was not mandatory to sign your name as the giver. Came Christmas Eve, the church was packed in eager anticipation of the gifts being handed out. Names were called, and the lucky person would walk to the tree, receive the gift, and return to his seat and unwrap the gift. One of the deacons, whose neck and features pitifully resembled a turkey gobbler's, openly cried of a broken heart. His gift, a bird's head and the words, to a man who needs a head and some brains. And a woman that had been saved received a liar's license. The air turned blue with her vituperations, which held the audience spellbound. His first name Abraham. The judge said he would ride the rope into the promised land. Before he met this fateful doom, the hanging law was dead. They took him down to Rayford Town to the electric chair instead. They strapped him in the electric chair, and so while he was waiting, the warden and the county sheriff were talking and debating which one of us must throw the switch and send this man to hell. But no decision could be reached, in prison he would dwell. They took him from the electric chair, his sweat had turned to blood. They told him that his life was spared, and from his eyes did flood the salty tears of gratefulness. It happens to all men. Down on his knees, he made this vow to never sit again. One day a prison gang did ride by pastures that were green. A mother with her baby strolled so happy and serene. Suddenly a vicious bull did charge this frightened wife. And Abraham, he jumped the fence and he saved this woman's life. Thank you.
garden full to Washington, his first name Abraham, who took a vow to never sit again while on this land. The last accounts of Washington, the day was cold and wet, was Abraham, have you kept your vow? And he said, I ain't set yet. When the moon's rays turn ghostly, the gray Spanish moss and the whippoorwill calls for his love that is lost, and the mist gently hangs o'er the water and sand, comes a mournful cry of a red and white man, Gopher John. He had understanding to copper and pale. His footsteps, they took him along every trail. And ever for honor and peace did he plead. But neither the white nor the red man did heed Gopher John. His bones now lie quietly beneath the warm sun, but his spirit, it wanders when nighttime has come through glen, glade, and forest. In deep swamps you'll hear the echo, peace, freedom, so softly and clear, Gopher John.
On a lonesome evening when the yellow moon is big and round and just above the trees, if you stand real still beside the old railroad bed, you may hear the mournful whistle of a ghost train and see the wood-burning BC coming down the track on her way home from Southport to Chipley. You may see the dancing light from the open firebox on the intent face of the engineer as the fireman feeds the hungry flames with fat pitch pine. You may see the oiler walking the sides, dexterously wielding his long spouted oil can, never wasting a drop. And if you were on this train as it went by an occasional dwelling place, invariably you'd see a figure on the porch, hand raised in wistful longing. And if you're a lucky person, you may have had the unforgettable experience of meeting Frog Smith, storyteller, yarn spinner, and the best doggone steam engine man to ever smell sawdust. Sounds from a sighing bawler was music to his ear, and on chilly Florida nights when it was cozy around the fire and possums were in his simmon trees, he'd make up his stories and store them in his mind for the future. The Pioneer Florida series contained several of his works. From Monkey to Cracker is hilarious, and his railroad stories are widely published. As of this writing, Mr. E.A. Frog Smith lives in semi-retirement at North Fort Myers, Florida. The following story, Florida's Walkingest Man, is one of his, and I am proud and honored to have his written permission to include this story in Florida Sand. A pair of long legs with big wide feet at the bottom made James Mitchell Acrefoot Johnson the walking champion of all time. Nobody can deny that it takes a good man to cover 65 miles on foot in one day, but he did it three times every week with a leather pouch full of United States mail slung over his broad shoulder. This almost unbelievable feat of Acrefoot Johnson, who was born in a log cabin near Lake City, Florida,
in the year 1853, is still on record in the U.S. Post Office Department. Johnson could actually outwalk a horse. It was near Wauchula, Florida, in 1880 that Acrefoot overtook a man in a buggy and was offered a ride. "No thanks," answered the plodding mail carrier in his characteristic drawl. "I'm in a sort of a hurry." Because Acrefoot seemed to be a friendly kind of person, the man in the buggy endeavored to carry on a conversation. But the mail carrier's stride was longer than that of a horse, and the man could only keep abreast by urging the animal into a trot. This wonderful specimen of cracker humanity stood better than 6 feet 7 inches barefoot, the way he usually went, and weighed more than 250 pounds. You quietly began to admit one of Acrefoot long before he became the man, but the name soon became legend after he started clearing the mill. And that was in 1877. Steamboats and barges were the only form of transportation in mail between Fort Meade and Punta Gorda at the mouth of the Peace River. And since mail delivery was badly needed to and from the mines and orange groves around Fort Meade, Bartow and Punta Gorda, a route was laid out, and Acrefoot took the job as carrier. For the next 7 years, he covered the 65-mile route on foot 3 days a week because he was never able to buy a horse on his wages of $26 a month. His loyalty to his job came before anything else. Once when several cattle barons offered to finance a trip to Washington, D.C., where a walking contest was being held, Acrefoot declined. "Sorry, boys," he said, "but the mail's got to go." And no one else would attempt to keep his schedule. Johnson felt that he was doing well on his meager salary, but like any other enterprising man, he was anxious to find a way to make some extra money. One day in 1884, a passing neighbor heard sounds of hammering near Acrefoot's house and stopped by to see what the mail carrier was doing when he had a day off. He found Acrefoot making a chair. Now, homemade chairs were common in Florida homes, but Acrefoot was building an armchair which he could carry on his back by means of a wide rawhide straps. "You see," Acrefoot explained, "the babies are coming along now, and I need to make a little more money. I'm going to take a passenger along with the mail." "Why, man, you can't do that," said the neighbor. "Only a horse can carry a man that far on his back. And I've been making better time than a horse could," laughed Acrefoot. "Climb into the chair and I'll show you." Worming his long arms into the straps, Acrefoot squatted for the neighbor to settle himself in the armchair. Then he started up the trail at a dog trot. After carrying the surprised man more than a mile, he stopped only long enough to turn around, and he went back the same way. When they returned to their starting point and the neighbor alighted, Acrefoot's breath was no more heard than when they left. "Beats a horse," admitted the neighbor. "Maybe someday I'll ride down to Fort Myers on your back." Acrefoot answered him, "Any day you feel like it." While his chair idea was a success, it changed the whole course of Acrefoot's life. What could have been the first star mail route to carry passengers was nipped in the bud when Acrefoot's request was firmly turned down by the Post Office Department. After asking and being refused a second time, he handed in his resignation. Quitting the mail-carrying game for good, he sold his home in Fort Ogden and moved to what is now Nocatee, 4 miles south of Arcadia. There he went into the business of cutting cross ties and cordwood for the Florida Southern Railroad, which was then being built from Punta Gorda to Bartow. Nothing was ever heard of his racing the Florida Southern trains for a mail-carrying contract, but very likely Acrefoot could have given the wood-burning locomotives a good run for their money.
This one's called Acrefoot Johnson. Now Acrefoot Johnson toted U.S. mail in the state of Florida over mighty rough trail. He strode at pace no horse could meet, and he won his fame on account of his feet. Stood a little taller than a tie-tie tree, had legs like a pine in the scrub country, walked 65 miles in the course of a day, 3 times a week for to earn his pay.
Oh, he rode a little ways in a buggy one time, but then he took the fidgets and he grabbed a line. Hollered, "Oh, now, mister," he said with a frown, "I'm mighty much obliged, but you're slowing me down." Yes, he made him a chair out of ash and hide to wear on his back for people to ride. And him that did with a weak little laugh said, "I'll tell you, boys, that's a ride and a half." Uncle Sam stepped in, said, "You've had your fun, but you can't tote people on this mail run." So Acrefoot quit, went home, took a nap with a 7-foot gator line crossed his lap.
Not too many years ago, you could walk along the bank of just about any flowing stream of water in Florida and soon come upon a water wheel busily turning and hear the sounds of grinding stones as they pulverize corn into grits or meal, and a wonderful smell to tantalize your nose upon entry to the mill, and the miller, proud and watchful, making adjustments as needed, his clothing, eyebrows, hands and hair all white with meal dust. Outside the mill, empty wagons wait. Among the horses and mules, a span or two of oxen, moon-eyed and patient, chewing their cud. Women gathered closely together, swapping recipes and best cures for galloping croup, red itch, and other ills, and usually a few men peeking furtively over their shoulders just before the fruit jar's contents hit the stomach. The water flow to the wheel is diverted from the spillway, bringing quietness to the mill, for the day's grinding is done. The still warm sacks of meal going to respective vehicles, good-humored departures, and home to some mighty fine hoe cake or crackling bread. But perhaps around the bend of this spring-fed creek, or perhaps on another creek some miles away, you suddenly came upon a smaller water wheel and a shed-like structure built out of logs. The water power for this wheel is sluiced 60 yards from a pretty good-sized balling spring, and between where the sluice box ends at the top of the wheel and the head of the spring, there is a 30-foot drop. All around the structure are piles of bark and shavings and scent of ash, oak, bay, magnolia, hickory, and sassafras permeate the air. Inside the building, alongside the walls, are three 12-foot-long hollowed-out cypress logs. These vat-like objects contain assorted lengths of round, nearly perfect-sized bark-peeled wood, 3 inches in diameter. The wood is soaking in a mixture of sassafras, roots, and water. On racks overhead, hundreds of these pieces of wood are drying and seasoning. The humming of the lathe, the old but firm hands guiding chisels to sculptured beauty and artistry. The whistle of abandon ringing through the woods as he works, making household furniture. A Joree joyfully returning the whistle, his little feet flying, scratching the ground. All this is mote in hidden reaches of time and place.
Lake Okeechobee in south central Florida, just north of the Everglades, is the second largest freshwater lake wholly within the U.S. It covers 750 square miles. On September 12th to the 17th, 1928, a hurricane sweeping out of the West Indies virtually lifted the waters from the lake bed and sent them swirling down onto the adjacent countryside. 4,000 people were drowned.
There come a big flood. It drowned at 4,000 degrees was the mud. 'Twas nothing could withstand that great tidal wave. And the ghosts of the vanished still cry from the grave. Lord, hold back the waters of Lake Okeechobee, for Lake Okeechobee's blue waters are cold. When wild winds are blowing across Okeechobee, they're calling and seeking for other poor souls. Oh, Lake Okeechobee's blue waters are cold. The Seminole left there in haste and with speed. Their wise words of warning were given no heed. When the waters receded, great God, what a sight! Men, women, and children turned black as night. Lord, hold back the waters of Lake Okeechobee, for Lake Okeechobee's blue waters are cold. When wild winds are blowing across Okeechobee, they're calling and seeking for other poor souls. Oh, Lake Okeechobee's blue waters are cold. Now Lake Okeechobee is calm and serene. The land all around it is fertile and green. But the people get fearful when the wild winds do roam. They look at the earth dam and they think of their home. Lord, hold back the waters of Lake Okeechobee, for Lake Okeechobee's blue waters are cold. When wild winds are blowing across Okeechobee, they're calling and seeking for other poor souls. Oh, Lake Okeechobee's blue waters are cold.
Everybody who knew him declared he had a mighty mean left leg, for he could square dance all night long, do-si-do-ing. And when that caller yelled, "First couple out and hit the floor," his double shuffle slap-slap was a sight to behold. This enviable ability plus his hard-to-get attitude put him right on top in the girls' sparking race. Through sheer jealousy and meanness, a few of his friends made it up to put one over on him, and when he was told that there was a married woman living in town who deeply admired him and whose husband only came home once a month, his vanity overruled his caution. One night he eases into town and goes to her two-story house and knocks on the door. A soft voice from upstairs bids him enter and come on up and wait in the kitchen. This he did, easily finding the designated rendezvous, and was standing looking out the back door when all of a sudden he hears a loud stamping of feet downstairs on the front porch, the opening and banging shut of the door, and a stentorian voice saying, "I am home." The screen door nearly tore off its hinges as the would-be Don Juan made his exit down the back stairs to the ground and across the yard towards a patch of woods behind the house. Scrinch goes a sound, then a thud and a moan. A clothesline had caught him right smack in the mouth. The cracker thespians who staged this little drama were simply carried away, as attested to by their howls of laughter. Dark stream waters run, almost strangers to the sun. Ghostly dancers early morn, paying homage to green corn. Seminole, Seminole. Bitter hatreds they do fade, no more war cries in the glade. Basket weavers you have turned, many a white man's ways you've learned. Seminole, Seminole. Seminole, you noble race, there is honor in your face. You didn't ever lose your stand, this is still your golden land. Seminole, Seminole. Located in North Florida, lived a man whose livelihood primarily came from the hunting and capturing of wild hogs. The miles and miles of swamps nearby harbored droves of these tuskers, and this man owned a pack of hog dogs and an alcoholic burro. When this burro got a pint or so of booze under his belt, he was ready for hog hunting and would run with the dogs through the swamps chasing the wild hogs. This burro would actually run a hog down, catch the hog by an ear, and sit on this animal till a man could get to him and truss up the hog. This burro was a hog catcher and a half, and it is said his eyes would be bloodshot when he had a hangover.
There's a wild hog in Gov Hammer. I don't wish on any man. My blood nose is hurtful tushes, dark to brown and yellow sand. It was on a lonesome evening, pretty near the setting sun. Wasn't thinking I got careless, didn't even tote a gun. There he stood, his red eyes burning, slobber running down his jaw. Never seen a sight so fearful, chill me to my very maw. Times at night, I get to thinking, and the shivers colds my spine. I walks out into that moonlight, that old hog still on my mind. There's a wild hog in Guff Hammock. I don't wish on any man. My blood nose is hurtful tushes, dark to brown and yellow sand, dark to brown and yellow sand. Wild hog.
Listen, good people, a story I'll tell of a great swamp in Florida, a place called Tate's Hell, 140 square watery miles with millions of skeeters and big yellow flies, and where all about the moccasins lie with glittering death in their beady eye, where bull gators beller and panthers squall. Now this is a place to be shunned by all. Old Tate left Sumatra long about dark. He had his two big dogs, a puppy named Spark, an old long-tom shotgun, a sharp Barlow knife that panther would sure have the chase of his life. A little past moon down, the dog struck the scent. Through bramble and tie-tie, a running Tate went. For hours and hours until it was dawn, then Tate knew that he was a long way from home. He blowed through his gun barrel, the dogs did not hear. The panther had killed him, and now Tate felt fear. The sun was not shining, the mist it was thick. Oh Lordy, Tate hollered, I'm lost up the creek. He leaned back to rest and his eyes did not see. The big rattler struck him above the bent knee. The lick was so hard that a sprawling he fell. This was the beginning of poor old Tate's hell. He opened his Barlow and he grabbed him some moss. A cut he made one way, another across. He wrapped his leg tightly and tied it with string. Then sickness came on him. His body turned green. When Tate was discovered, these words he did tell. My name is old Tate, boys, I've just been in hell. These few spoken words were the last that he said. His spirit, it left him. Old Tate, he was dead. No man can dispute this legend of yore, how Tate lived a full week and then 5 days more, and somehow crawled out close to Caribel from that deep ghostly swamp that we know as Tate's Hell. Thank you.
captured under flag of truce and confined within the old Fort Castillo de San Marcos at St. Augustine in late 1837, Osceola knew that for him the sands of time had run their course. Wildcat, Osceola's most trusted friend, who also had been taken under this flag of white, pleaded with Osceola to escape the fort with him, but Osceola refused. Late one night, with Osceola's final instructions to his people burning in his heart, Cocuchi slithered through a tiny air vent to the ground outside the fort. The spitting snarl of a wildcat hushed the night sounds momentarily. The Seminole War would continue. Osceola was transported from the old fort to Fort Moultrie, South Carolina, there avoiding all nourishment and medicines to his quincy-racked body, he soon gave up the ghost. His head was severed from his torso, and his remains were buried on Sullivan's Island, where they lay until 1966. Osceola's bones now rest in an unmarked grave somewhere in the land of flowers he so dearly loved. Esta hadki holo wagas loxi ojas.
I beg you go with me to stand against our mortal foe. But Osceola raised his proud head high, said, do this ere I die. Wildcat brother, to the grassy waters, take the Seminole there. No white man can invade to leave you lying dead and cold. I shall not live among such evil men who mock the sign of truce, this flag of white, and honor not their given sacred word. My name will be the light that burns in every warrior's soul. In dark and hidden reaches, they will never drive us from our land, nor drain our blood like leeches. My spirit walks with those of you who die, and those of you who always will remain upon this blood-stained, blessed, flowered land, must fight and fight again. Cedar Key lived a man so proud and free. Nature learned him many secrets of her ways, learned him how to know the fires burning in the critter's eyes, filled his heart with restless music, sad and gay. Creatures stirring in the night stopped to listen with no fright to Cush Holston as he sang and played. Fingers dancing on the strings, rosin low made fiddle ring, filled the air so softly with strange music. Got arrested, put in jail, caged up this mind of will, as a lordly horn owl wanting to be free. Come time to turn him go, his face so full of woe, people broke his heart with thoughtless mockery. Took his gun and he did go to a place where no one knows. Vanished like the cold mist leaves river sand. Gone back to nature's own, still living free alone. Lonely is the mournful cry of the sad man. The whispers he, living so proud and free, 'cause Holston's gone back to nature's weeds. She will no secrets tell of Cush and where he lives. Will know the west he will ever remain.
People are acquainted with this expression, "You ain't got no more sense than God give a billy goat." The recipient of this compliment should feel proud, because a billy goat's the smartest animal to be found anywhere. Naturally, a goat baby has to be weaned like any other baby. Even baby chicks have to be taught to peck and scratch. But once a goat's off that white stuff, a goat is surety against intruders. No sane person or varmint will stay very long in a yard where a full-grown billy goat's running around loose. In some ways, a goat's smarter than a lot of people. And to prove a point, ponder this little ditty. Oh, the goat feeds east to the morning sun. The goat feeds west at the turn. Well, the sun never shines on that sweet goat's behind, for it's tender and likely to burn. Walk along the beaches during the daytime. You'll see a multitude of sunburned humans. Viva El Sol. And here's something for the wives' ears only. If you treasure your plants, flowers, and